You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Europe's migrant crisis deepens yet further, with 71 people now believed to have suffocated in a truck in Austria. Against such suffering is the argument over terminology, migrant, refugee, really that important. I'll ask today's studio guests, Jane Kinnamont and John Everard. Plus, we'll cast our gaze from Europe to Australia, where public outrage has erupted at an increasingly militarised border force and one hapless deployment thereof. We'll also discuss this week's horrific murder of two American journalists on live television. Many news outlets have stopped showing the footage, but as it continues to circulate online, should people watch it? All that, plus a quick trip to Spain, where a tiny village is advertising for a new resident hermit. What, we will wonder, are the hours? We'll have all the answers coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and John Everard, former UK Ambassador to Belarus and North Korea, among other postings, author of the Pyongyang memoir Only Beautiful Please. Welcome both back to the show. It is now believed that 71 people, apparently Syrian, died in the back of a refrigerator truck discovered yesterday by Austrian police near the border with Hungary. Since then, two more boats embarking from Libya have sunk, with the probable loss of hundreds. The July just passed, nevertheless, broke all records for entries into the EU, nudging 110,000. Of the many arguments sparked within Europe by this influx and the associated questions of obligation and guilt, one is of terminology. What should we call these people? Migrants, illegal immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers, any of a numberless quantity of less tactful epithets. And does it really matter anyway? Al Jazeera is the latest organisation which is going to stop calling them migrants, start calling them refugees. Jane, I'll ask you first. This reminds me at least a little bit of the inane quibbling over what to call Islamic State. Is this a way of avoiding the actual problem? It's an argument about something else, or even a way of recognising that there isn't actually a solution to the problem.
Much as I hate to disagree with you, Andrew, I think it is important. I think this current migration debate is mixing up a lot of different issues and flagging the fact that many of those coming to Europe are refugees, a category which brings with it various legal and moral obligations.
Indeed so.
It's needed to separate it from this wider debate about benefits tourism or the free flow of labour within the EU.
But we can't call them all refugees, though, can we? Because they're clearly not. I mean, a great many of them doubtless are, but it would be absurd to suggest that every single one of these people is a refugee.
That's right. You've got a combination of people. Their status is going to be hard to ascertain, but we have to recognise there is a massive refugee problem from Syria. There are about 8 million Syrians displaced, 3 million of them outside the country. And one of the many policy issues that Europe has to grapple with is how do you resettle those people? They can no longer stay entirely in the tiny regional countries that surround them. So there needs to be some kind of deliberate policy to bring some of them to Europe, to bring some of them to America, to find places for them to live.
John, I looked it up earlier in the Oxford Dictionary, which defines migrant as a person who moves from one place to another in order to find work or better living conditions. That's a reasonably neutral term, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. I think, you know, this question has different layers to it. Firstly, there is just a question of semantics, which is essentially, are we going to include refugees? And refugee in international law is a very specific term, and it triggers all kinds of rights and expectations of a host country. But are we going to call refugees also migrants? Does the term migrant embrace refugees, or are we going to say that migrants are simply those who are trying to better themselves economically? Secondly, are we going to keep calling these people migrants? As opposed to other words that have fallen out of favour for no obvious reason. We used to call them exiles, remember? When you were fleeing a horrible regime with the expectation that after a while things would return to normal and you'd go back home, you were called an exile, which had a sort of quite a positive ring to it. Also, when we have migrants who do not have dark skins, they are not migrants, they are expats.
I speak as one such myself.
Yes, a migrant. but, I mean, I think as an international community, we've got to get our words straight. These words all have connotations. They're all slightly loaded. And it does make me feel slightly uneasy that if you are, say, a Brit working in Hong Kong, you're an expat. If you are a Nigerian trying to find work in the UK, you're a migrant. Which is which?
Jane, do you think that terminology... I mean, specifically looking at this decision Al Jazeera has made, stop calling them migrants, start calling them refugees. If, say, every major media outlet covering this, and obviously not every major media outlet for reasons of their own is likely to, but say if it became the default, if the BBC, CNN, similar sort of Leviathan started embracing the phrase refugee rather than migrant, would it make any actual difference to the tone of the debate? Would it reframe the conversation, do you think?
I think it would highlight the very large element that is coming from political refugees and from political conflicts. And I think it might help focus attention on the need to deal with some of the root causes of those conflicts, not simply increase the barriers.
I mean, what is clear is that whatever we choose to call these people, they are not going to stop coming. The stories in the last 48 hours, even by the standards of this ongoing story, have been just horrendous. The story is in the early stages about the two most recent sinkings of boats embarking from Libya, but the numbers, again, will be catastrophic. At what point, John, is it possible to imagine that this stops even looking like a vaguely manageable problem? And because the thing is, it's my sense at least that European governments are trying to avoid this conversation as far as possible because they're well aware that there is, to put it tactfully, extremely limited sympathy among a lot of European populations for these people.
Yes,
but at what point does it become actually unignorable regardless of that?
Firstly, it's not all European governments. I mean, the Germans and the Swedes, to their credit, have stood up and said, we have to confront this, we have to have a conversation, there has to be a European response, and this is a vast humanitarian crisis. Secondly, it is manageable. If you decide that you recognise the problem, the numbers involved, they're very large, you're quite right. They are not so large that we could not cope with them if we decided seriously that we are going to do so. But you need that political decision and you need the resource commitment that corresponds to this wave of humanity, or whatever they are. Thirdly, if I just come back on the point you were making just now to Jane, I am getting worried that we are trying to decide whether these people are migrants or to call these people migrants or refugees. Some of them are refugees, some of them are migrants. And I think we should back away from using one term to cover everybody. They come for quite different reasons and need to be treated differently.
I mean, the trouble is then just thinking from a point of view of just basic script writing logistics, you start ending up sort of like stacking absurd piles of nomenclature to try and catch everybody. And I mean, Jane, do you think there is a better word than migrant, or has that now become what is in theory, but in the dictionary, an entirely neutral word to describe what a person does? Has it now acquired baggage beyond that that makes it pejorative?
I think the term economic migrant is quite useful, but even that has been used often to suggest that those are somehow benefits tourists or people who have a free choice, whereas, of course, people escaping extreme poverty from a country such as Yemen, for instance, may also have very little choice and be equally desperate.
And backing up John's point, nobody ever calls people of my skin colour economic migrants, though that's exactly what I am.
You're not an exile from Australia?
I'm really not. I go back all the time. They even seem quite happy to see me. But is there a way of, I guess, recalibrating the debate in that sense? Is there a better word than migrant?
I think, I mean, migrant is a perfectly good word. I think that it, I mean, as you rightly say, if you start to, in script writing or in journalism, to distinguish between all these people, you end up with whole sentences rather than a single word, which starts to get just a little bit cumbersome. And I would say, I would quote T.S. Eliot, that where words are sick, it is our duty to heal them. If you think the word migrant has started to acquire bad connotations, strike back and talk positively about migrants. Try and shift the balance back a bit.
Well, on a not unrelated subject, let's look now at my homeland of Australia, where Prime Minister Tony Abbott might well, as we speak, be sitting in a darkened room with a bottle of whiskey and a funnel. He has had one of those days. At issue is something which was to have been called Operation Fortitude, a wheeze which would have dispatched the country's new Australian Border Force Agency onto the streets of Melbourne to conduct random searches for illegal immigrants. Following a chorus of jeers laced with laughter and protests, this self-evidently idiotic idea was abandoned, officials choosing to blame a clumsily worded press release. Jane, this does seem to have been, as so many things are, the result of one of those meetings at which nobody asked the question, what could possibly go wrong? This is preposterous, but what is this actually signifying here, this idea of turning this militarised border force onto the streets? Who is supposed to be impressed by this?
It's interesting because it suggests a very securitised and defence-based attitude towards migration.
Yeah, whereas, welcome to Australia. Or not, as the case may be.
I mean, perhaps your history has shown you the risks of people coming from overseas and taking over your country.
The irony is ever present, yes.
But usually the factors that are driving anti-immigration parties have a lot more to do with economics. And if you're trying to deal with the economic impact of migration, balance the winners and losers, seeking out individual illegal migrants is not the way to deal with it.
No, I mean, clearly the idea, as stated, John, it was theatre, wasn't it? Really?
Well absolutely, and the word has got out that this was a bunch of politicians looking for an announceable, apparently it's called in Australia, for a certain days of a conference, and someone came up with this wizard wheeze. Of course, it was crazy. Of course, it was going to fail. It is not stupid to check streets for illegal migrants, if that is the word we're deciding on at the end. But, you know, if people have broken visa regulations, the law enforcement authorities have the right and the duty to pick them up. Random searches, I think, starts to go back to 1960 Detroit, and I think that was a seriously bad idea. But in many countries where you have, for example, photos of migrants, a lot of police are equipped with these to spot them in case they come up in a crowd, and I think that would be legitimate.
Although, to reinforce your earlier point, John, I don't imagine that British backpackers, rather overstaying their visas, was going to be the priority.
Probably not. Can I also make the point about the military aspect of this? One of the debates that we always used to have in government when I was there, and I don't suppose it's come to an end yet, is how far you want to direct people who are enforcing your border security. Do you have a military-style force where everybody has a kind of an order book, a green card, effectively, with detailed instructions written down on them, which you follow to the letter, or do you allow people a certain amount of latitude in how they deal with asylum seekers, migrant refugee seekers, and so on? The problem with the latter approach, it gives a more human face, but it means you get inconsistencies. And it's one of those debates that I'm sure goes on in other governments too, and to which there's probably no single good solution.
Jane, I wanted to ask you, because it's happening a lot in your particular area of interest, the Middle East and North Africa, and I know this because I've been writing a story for a Monocle print thing this week about the fortification of borders, which is becoming an increasing thing. When the Berlin Wall came down, there were 16 fortified borders in the world. There's now 65, and that number is increasing. And I spoke to people involved in the building of them who just said there is no danger at all of that trend reversing as the technology becomes cheaper and more accessible. Is it always necessarily a bad thing? Is there something to be said for the Robert Frost dictum that, you know, good neighbours require good fences?
Well, you see a number of these things in the Middle East that tend to bring sometimes direct protection from some security threats, but also political problems with them. So Saudi Arabia has been trying for a long time to build a border along its to build a wall along its border with Yemen and also with Iraq. Neither of those is a particularly good example of successfully safeguarding the country. Of course, you've got the barrier that Israel is building around itself and into the West Bank. That's not a long and internationally recognised border, so that's brought a huge amount of political problems with it. But many Israelis would say that that has contributed to a reduction in suicide bombings. Whether it brings you a sustainable security is a much bigger question. More dubious.
John, is it perhaps arguable that I think people got very caught up in the idea of the Berlin Wall, the great symbol of the wall being broached, but I think everyone rather forgot that the Iron Curtain was never built to keep people out. It was built to keep people in. And the other fortified barriers in the world have the more obvious, imperative, which is to keep people out. Is it arguable that post-Berlin Wall European idea, that the Schengen Agreement was perhaps somewhat naive?
Well, yes, or putting it more generally, I think, you know, as a world, we have to make up our minds whether we think that the free movement of people is a good thing or a bad thing. And you hear people now passionately arguing one way or the other. If you think it's a bad thing, then for whatever reason, then okay, putting up physical defences, walls, fences, whatever you want to do, makes a certain amount of sense. But I have to say, okay, maybe I'm an old-fashioned Schengenist and I remember the Berlin Wall coming down, but it sent shivers up and down my spine. You know, I still think that people should be allowed, within reason at least, to wander around the world freely and to go and talk to each other.
Jane, is there the same imperative there always was, or you know, it's always been this idea that countries are defined by their borders? Does John have a point there? Are they being made slightly redundant by the increasing movement of people? Because certainly the governments of a lot of countries think otherwise, and especially in Europe, we're seeing Hungary walling off its border with Serbia, Bulgaria trying to wall off its border with Turkey. Is it possible that we might be returning to a pre-Schengen arrangement?
It's a two-tier system. At the end of the day, walls are going to prevent people who might cross on foot or in a car. The wealthy aren't going to be affected by walls. I think increasingly you have elites in most countries of the world who absolutely expect mobility as almost a right. They will talk at conferences about international politics and economics about a world where borders don't really matter anymore and we're all part of a global village. That's not the reality for the vast majority of the world's population.
Absolutely. And one of the things that strikes me, just because what I do, I tend to rub shoulders with these elites quite often, is how they have this deep sense of expectation that they should be allowed to travel the world freely, but not their poorer countrymen. And when you hear, for example, senior Pakistanis talking about Pakistani migrants coming to Western Europe, you blink. I mean, it's as if they're talking about a subhuman race quite often. Ditto quite often rich Nigerians. There's quite a lot of doublethink going on.
And just, a final thought on this from both of you. The fortified borders that we are increasingly seeing, and this has just been whirling around my head this week, so I've been writing about it. Do you think they actually are there to do what they're theoretically intended to do, either keep people out, or are they mostly there for the benefit of the people on the other side, that they're a symbol built by the government to say to the people, look, we are actually trying to deal with what is, frankly, a completely unsolvable problem, but we don't want to say that?
There's always an element of big physical security arrangements, which is intended to reassure people. It comes back to the issue of theatre.
I think there's an element of theatre, I agree. I think a lot depends on where you build your wall, how high you build it, and how long that wall is. We're talking just now about the Berlin Wall. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Berlin Wall, but we have to remember that for a long time it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It did keep people out or in, depending on your perspective. Some other walls now being built will be able to do that if they're properly manned and built sort of tough enough. Others, I think, are pure theatre.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jane Kinnamont and John Everard on Monocle 24. Coming up next, the Virginia journalist shooting and also a career in professional hermitude.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
And And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont and John Everard. Now, as recently as 20 years ago, the snuff movie, that is, verite footage of murder filmed for the purposes of entertainment, was the stuff of urban legend. Today, they're so frequent as to be barely remarkable as a phenomenon, most luridly, of late in the propaganda videos of Islamic State. But a hideous variant was created this week by Vesta Flanagan, a disgruntled former employee of a Virginia TV station who killed two of his former colleagues on air and also uploaded his own film of the murders on the internet. It is one of those things, as all these things are, where, you know, I think most sort of half-awake people feel a competition in their heads between decorum and curiosity. Have either of you watched it?
No.
Jane?
No, and I haven't watched any videos in which somebody actually gets killed.
No, nor have I, because I just can't imagine why you would want to. I suspect, though, that the answer, if you asked a sort of random panel of about 115 year olds, might be rather different, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I think it's probably normal now.
There has been some argument floated in the wake of this killing that, and I think people are possibly, this is possibly journalists struggling too hard to fill up 600 words, but suggesting that it should be watched as kind of an education in the reality of what gun crime actually looks like up close. I'll ask you first, John, do you think there is anything to that?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's one of those questions to which there is no good answer. On the one hand, you don't want to encourage people to watch people being killed just out of prurient delight, if that's the word, in watching violence. I mean, it encourages all kinds of bad habits. You also have to take into account the feelings of the victims' families, of bystanders and lots of other people, and elements of human dignity involved. On the other, I think there is a risk that if you turn that into a blanket ban on people being able to see what it looks like when somebody is torn apart with gunshot wounds, that you create a taboo. And I think that that kind of taboo, where you just don't talk about what guns do to people, is unhealthy. I think, you know, it's one of those questions where the best answer is probably a balance between the two. And I'm really not sure myself where that balance lies.
No, I'm not sure either. And I was thinking about it this week, you know, trying to figure. I mean, I suspect it is an unanswerable question, like John says. But Jane, I was thinking this week that there were two other stories which struck me the same way. There was the Shoreham air disaster, where the plane crashed during an air show, killed at least 11 people, I think, in the south of England. And weirdly, a lot of the broadcasters they were showing the plane descending, and then they were showing the explosion afterwards, but cutting the moment of impact, which I thought was a weird decision. And there was also the death of Justin Wilson, the British racing driver at the in an IndyCar race at Pocono, where they showed the accident while he was still in a coma and then stopped showing it when it was announced he'd died. Are there any hard and fast rules here, do you think?
I think it's something broadcasters are really grappling with. I remember, I think about 3 years ago, going back to Syria, there was a big debate about showing some of the more graphic images, photographs rather than videos of dead people from that conflict. And I think it was The Independent who went further than others in publishing some photos. However, fast forward a few years and the same things are happening. We don't see pictures of them and we don't even hear about them. So it's one example where actually showing the detail and the reality hasn't really led to much of a change in opinion.
John, that debate Jane mentions has, I'm sure, gone on in newspapers and television newsrooms as long as there's been newsrooms, about, you know, the what to show, how much of it to show, how much of something you need to show to make the point, and how far, you know, obviously, it's I think everyone's familiar with the parameters of it. But in the current media landscape, to what extent has that debate been rendered redundant? Because even if people won't show, and no responsible broadcaster, for example, would ever show an Islamic State beheading video, but anybody who actually wants to see one is not going to have any trouble finding it.
Yes, you're right. And actually, the situation we're in, so it's not entirely healthy, but I think may have the germs of a solution. If you don't actually broadcast these killings, but you make them available to some people, and, you know, it'd be, I think, really good if you could find a way of, I don't know, an age cutoff so that your sort of 15-year-old doesn't necessarily go and see these things, that may be a way forward. Can I just mention in passing one detail of all this that it always intrigues me? If you watch Chinese execution videos and the Chinese film people when they're shot, you always see the executioner leaning towards the victim with his gun cocked. And then the film cuts and you see the body lurching forward. For some reason, they will never actually show the moment of death.
Those moments of squeamishness, as I was saying earlier, they're very, very peculiar. The calibrations are really, really weird. But I guess, Jane, to think about this specific case in the specific environment of America, and there's been a few, you know, as there always are, and as there will be the next time something like this happens, you know, people saying that this surely is where, you know, there will be a sea change in America's relationship with guns. Does it advance the argument, or has this only become a story because there's film of it? I mean, it would be an unusual day in America in which there isn't a double murder.
I think for Americans who believe that they should have the right to have guns, it's a little bit like saying, there's been another car crash, let's ban cars.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's exactly the case, and I suspect we will have ample opportunity to discuss America and guns in the future, regrettably. But finally tonight, a job opportunity we should look at. It is literally and figuratively a singular vocation, but it may sound enticing to anyone who has, to deploy a completely random example, spent their tube journey into work sitting opposite some mouth-breathing Yahoo actually clipping his fingernails on the central line.
At least it wasn't his toenails.
Yeah. That thought did occur to me. You take what you can, you really do. A medieval sanctuary in Catalonia is seeking a resident hermit. The money is frankly lousy. It's a 1,000 euro stipend for the entire year. But the accommodation is free and spectacular. It is a rambling rocktop pile overlooking the village of Montreuil del Camp, almost certainly grotesquely mispronounced. Apologies to all our listeners there. Jane, are you tempted in the slightest?
There'll probably be a lot of applicants from Catalonia, given the incredibly high rate of unemployment there. This might be one of the more appealing things to do. But I think it's something fascinating just because it's so incredibly different from everybody's normal life. And the very idea of the story about a hermit vacancy becoming viral is quite ironic in itself.
Well, this is what I was actually wondering, and John, this has been noted as a phenomenon around the developed world, but especially in Korea, the incredible rise of, you know, single person households. Is this not just? I mean, nobody, I don't think, has ever said, "Gosh, I wish I had less living space." Is this basically just like the reductive essence of a fairly universal human desire, just to be left the hell alone?
Well, yes, and taken to an extreme level. Or at least it used to be that. But looking at this ad, I see that hermitude isn't quite what it once was.
This is the bit that put me off as well, I think, you're about to get to.
Okay, well, let's see if we focus on the same bits. Quite apart from this, you know, the 1,000 euros the entire year, paid quarterly, so you don't even get the 1,000 euros up front. It turns out that you are not allowed to sit all by yourself. You've got to go out and be nice to visitors and explain the mysteries of the sanctuary. Moreover, you read a bit further down into the Catalan advertisement and you discover that the accommodation is for you and your family. So you're not entirely solo there. You could bring the wife and kids along as well. Further down...
You can imagine a lot of people read the advertisement going, this sounds amazing, and got to that point and went, oh.
Yes, I think that is likely. Further, near the bottom, it says the hermit must have his own vehicle. I'm not sure that the 12th century predecessor would have recognised this.
I think this is fairly lightweight hermitude, the more you talk about it. Jane, the successful candidate must, it says here, also leave all uncivil or immoral activity outside.
Boring.
And you will also be required to perform all the proper duties of a hermit. And again, I would have thought all the proper duties of a hermit would just basically involve being left alone and doing nothing. Does this sound like a job for you, do you think?
I think I'm going to withdraw my application. I think the chatting nicely to visitors just isn't consistent with the proper duties of a hermit.
No, that's right. I think we should go start the movement for real hermitude. I mean, hermits are probably left alone, not driving cars around, not with their families, and not mixing it with the visitors. Let's go for it.
Sensible policies for a happier world. We will have to leave it there. John Everard and Jane Kinnamont, thank you as ever for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Aidan McLaughlin. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett is keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie is in at 1900 with The Menu. At 2200, it's The Daily with, I think I'm right in saying, Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.